We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poop on your bound to die. I met her on the mountain. There I took her life. Met her on the mountain. Stabbed her with my knife. Everybody.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. I'm Leanne Donner, sitting in this morning for David Inge. And we have a very interesting book to talk about this morning. My guest is Robert Wells, author of Life Flows On, an Endless Song, Folk Songs and American History. Thank you for joining us this morning. We'll invite you into the conversation as we have a lot of music to listen to and a lot of discussion about it. The number to call is 217-333-9455 or toll-free 800-222-9455. We all have ideas of what we think of as folk music, but this book takes it several steps further and really encompasses a lot of tunes that you might not think of as folk music. Robert Wells is our guest. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So you start out the book, you get our attention right away with Tom Dooley, and I have to say, if my sixth grade glee club teacher had known that a sexually transmitted disease was in that backstory, we probably wouldn't have been allowed to sing it in our fall concert.
That's probably true. It's better that the story was hidden for a lot of people, I think. But it's what makes it interesting is to actually learn the backstory.
So tell us about his name was actually Tom Dooley.
Dooley, actually, and Dooley was a kind of North Carolina pronunciation. So. But his Tom Dooley was a Confederate war veteran who, depending on who you read, had something of a shady reputation before he even went into war. And he was he was captured, and then after the war was over, came back to North Carolina and took up with three women, actually, Laura Foster, Pauline Foster, and Annie Foster Melton, who were cousins. Annie Foster Melton was obviously married, and somewhere along the line, she got some kind of venereal disease, possibly syphilis, and from Tom, and was not pleased to have to inform her husband of this. And they decided between the two of them that Laura was the one who had given it to Tom, though in fact Pauline, I think, was actually in the neighborhood being treated for some kind of VD. And they seemed to have murdered her as revenge for this. And Tom fled the territory, was eventually arrested or kind of seized by Mr. Grayson, who's in the song, had brought back and was tried, actually, and was convicted and was duly hung. They did find Laura's body. The question in the community was how much Annie Foster Melton had actually had to do with this, whether she just had kind of pushed Tom into doing this or whether she actually had a hand in it. So it's kind of an interesting story there. And then, you know, the local community had this going on for a long time. Doc Watson's grandmother actually was supposed to have been at the bedside of Annie Melton when she died.
Wow, that's a real direct connection to the actual story behind this interesting and somewhat changing folk song, because the versions that we get today are cleaned up a little bit.
So actually, Doc Watson's versions are a little bit blunter. You know, he tells a little bit more of the story, but clearly the Kingston Trio one is kind of what happened here. You know, you have no idea what this poor girl did to end up getting murdered and kind of where or why, but we know a lot about it.
It certainly sounds more like a story of lost love than a story of revenge that it seems like it is. So tell us, what does this particular folk song tell us about that era?
Well, I think it tells us a number of different things. One, I think, is that actually northern newspapers, including the New York Herald Tribune, actually sent reporters down there to cover this. the story. And that's actually partly how we know it, because there are news reports of the trial and the kind of evidence. And I think this tells us in part about Northern attitudes towards the South right after the Civil War, and this kind of look at these horrible people and all the things they're doing. So that that story is embedded in it. Tom Dooley, as a kind of genre, fits into a type of song that's been called the Murdered Girl Ballads. And these are songs that develop, really, the first one, kind of classic, is a song called Omi Wise from 1808, where Naomi Wise was misled by a man by the name of John Lewis, was seduced and betrayed and eventually murdered. And so this is a series of songs that I think are at least in part designed to warn young women to be careful with the men they take up with.
So we really, really see the changes in the mores of society reflected in the folk songs of the time.
Very much so. People have in a number of different genres, you know, plays and dramas and novels and poetry, theater, have observed that at the end of the 18th, or in the early part of the 18th century and going back into the 17th century, women are often portrayed as active and aggressive and dangerous to men, and then all of a sudden this flip-flops, and it's men who are dangerous to women, that women need to be protected and need to be careful. And I think you see this in these series of folk songs, and some have linked this to, in a sense, the decline of parental involvement in marriage, so that men and women are courting, kind of marrying for love rather than for economic reasons, and parents are not less than so much involved. And so this is really parents' way of saying, listen up here, listen to what can happen to you if you aren't at least a little cautious in who you court and who you take up with.
I love the way you have organized your book. Obviously the songs of courtship, marriage, and children, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory. The Man Who Never Returned, that's an interesting, we think about it, and actually a lot of the folk songs that we know and love are those kinds of songs.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen. I want to talk more about those in a moment. But Chapter 3, Mine Eyes Have Seen the Glory, most of us don't think about a lot of songs that we consider very patriotic as folk songs. Talk about your criteria for what you included.
Okay, yes. It's actually interesting. And, I'm a historian. I'm not a folk musicologist. And so I've kind of come into this literature as an interested outsider. And you get definitions about what a folk song is all the way from the kind of very narrow extreme of folk songs have to, you can't have an own author, that it has to have evidence of being somehow or other composed around the campfire or around the fire at night in the cabin somewhere and collective. And if we have any remote sense about who might have composed it, then it isn't a folk song. All the way to the other end, that's kind of Pete Seeger, and that's actually kind of Pete Seeger's father, Charles, was one of the people that pushed for this narrow definition. But Pete himself at one point said, well, a folk song's anything the folks are singing. And I think we need something in between there. And so what I've used in this book, and partly for my own kind of satisfaction for playing and singing folk songs as an amateur, was, first of all, that they had to at some point had gone into oral transmission. That is, you learned it from listening to your neighbor sing. I think today we learn songs off records and tapes and things like that, but you learned it not off a piece of sheet music or out of a book, but from hearing it. And so something like Battle Hymn of the Republic, clearly, or Amazing Grace, we do know the authors of these lyrics. We know that these are written down, but people hear these things, and so I'm willing to consider that as a folk song. A couple of other definitions. Malcolm Laws, who's studied American ballads, describes folk songs as having a certain kind of simplicity and style. And I think, we all have a sense of knowing what that means, even though it's pretty hard to define. But a simple style, simple chord pattern, simple lyrics, nothing too complicated. I guess by way of kind of contrast, I like Paul Simon's music terrifically, but his music is far too complicated to be real folk songs as far as I'm concerned. The third element comes from Norm Cohn, who has done a wonderful book on railroad songs, and he basically says folk songs are songs that were sung for basically kind of private enjoyment and not for commercial purposes, written and composed and sung for that. And then I guess the other point is that folk songs are not museum pieces that need to be locked up, but there's a certain kind of living quality to them, which leads to, I suppose, the final point about a folk song, and that is that it's not a folk song, it's folk songs. There's no one version, there's no one definition of a song, there's no perfect text. You know, the different people sing different texts for a variety of reasons that we can talk about later if you want. And so a folk song is a living, breathing entity, and you know, one learns one version and somebody else learns another version, and that's fine.
You made reference to that you're not a musician. How you are a historian. Let's talk a moment about your background. Did you know early on that you wanted to be a historian? Is it something that you came to and when you were in college? And did you know that you were going to pursue this interest in music as it fits in with history?
Well, you know, I suppose they actually both probably date from about the same time when I was in high school. As I say in the introduction, my older brother came home from college with a couple of folk song albums and a cheap guitar, and I hadn't heard any of this, and I kind of picked it up and went from there, and I must have probably been 15 or 16 when I started playing, and I was as interested in history at that time, too, and was a history major in college, and was also, you know, learning folk songs without much systematic approach to it at the time. So these kind of follow along together, and it was only much later that I really began to undertake the serious study of it. I think I explained that, you know, early on with my teaching career, I started here at Union College in 1969, and within a couple of years, was giving one lecture in my early American history class. I had learned enough songs from the wonderful Alan Lomax Folk Songs of North America book that were clearly colonial. All right, let me give them 50 minutes worth of music. But the full course that eventually led to the book was really only about 10 years old at this point. But I've been interested in history and songs for a long time, and it's a nice way in which my avocation, which is the music, obviously, or the singing, kind of branched over to the history. But, you know, realistically, this is a book about lyrics rather than about music.
Absolutely.
You know, and I can play the guitar well enough that I'm willing to, you know, accompany myself when I sing in class, but I don't consider myself a professional musician and certainly not capable of understanding all the kind of sophisticated nuances of the music.
You're listening to Focus 580. I'm Leanne Donner sitting in this hour for David Inge, and we invite you to join in the conversation at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Our guest this morning is Robert Wells. He's the author of Life Flows On, An Endless Song, Folk Songs and American History. Let's talk for a moment about why different texts or why a song changes or is different in one region than in another.
Okay. Musicologists have talked about this in a variety of different ways, and there are lots of interesting reasons. I mean, some of it, it gets localized. For example, there are logger songs that start in Maine and then move to upstate New York and then move to Michigan as the logging industry moves west and then end up, you know, out in Montana or in Idaho, and they simply, you know, take the basics of the song and then put names and places in that are localized. Some of the reasons songs change, as I'm sure all of us when we try and remember things, you know, if we try to remember a joke or a story or a song, we kind of get to some point that, oh, there's something missing here, you know, and it's just the kind of process of memory. And I know myself with songs that sometimes I know this, I've got half a verse here, right, and I know what the song is supposed to say, so I'm going to make up what I've forgotten. So you kind of fit it in there. Sometimes people feel uncomfortable with a verse. I think we started with the Tom Dooley, and there are, I think, verses that are a little bit blunter than what the Kingston Trio sang, and it may well be, I mean, I think that may have been at least partially edited to make it a commercially viable record, but, you know, people might be uncomfortable singing about certain things. There's a wonderful recording of Leadbelly talking about his song about the Titanic, when he talks about verses that he didn't always sing for every audience, that he selected the verses he wanted to sing for particular audiences depending on how comfortable he was and how he thought they would respond. So lots of reasons that songs can change.
And then there are songs you point out in your book that come from biblical texts, mm-hmm. So they tend not to change much, but the way that we use them changes a lot.
Sure.
And you talk about the examples of Amazing Grace and We Shall Overcome. And if you don't mind, maybe we'll take a listen to a little bit of We Shall Overcome.
We shall overcome, we shall overcome, we shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart,
it's become an anthem for many, many causes, including, of course, the civil rights movement. And I think it's easy to forget that it goes back to a biblical text.
A 19th century hymn that then kind of moved into the labor movement song and then kind of got picked up by the civil rights era song. So these songs have wonderful kind of continuity in different contexts, but they still carry profound meanings for people. And obviously that's a song where, you know, it's what Lee Hayes of the Weavers, one of Pete Seeger's colleagues with the Weavers, called the zipper song, which has always been a favorite phrase of mine. Where,
what is a zipper song?
A zipper song where you're singing a song, and basically it has a chorus that you can keep repeating, and maybe just a two-line couplet. And as long as anybody can think up a new couplet remember one from another song, and kind of you just zip it in. And so it's great for if you're marching, whether it's, you know, a strike or whether it's a civil rights protest, or if you're marching as a soldier, that you can kind of keep the song going, as I said, as long as anybody can think up anything new and just zip in a new verse.
I think that probably the train songs are some of favorites of many people, and I mean there are some that are obviously based on, or you would assume they are based on a real story.
Mm-hmm.
What about the wreck of the old 97? Was that a real wreck?
Wreck of old 97 was in fact a real wreck that occurred, I believe, in 1903. Yes, it was kind of September 27th, 1903. And it was, again, a classic story, lots of railroad wreck songs about trying to make up for lost time. I think there's kind of a theme that actually even links back in some ways to John Henry about the demands of the industrial age and the machine age, and, you know, trying to make the trains run efficiently. And Joseph Brody was the engineer heading south, and he had to make up lost time and was going down a hill too fast, and there was a bridge at the bottom go over a ravine, and it was a bridge on a curve, and he jumped the track. And actually, there are photographs. You can, you know, go to Google Images and put Wreck of Old 97, and you can see the photographs of the engine and the cars, you know, the Sunday morning down in the ravine. So this was a story, but it was also a song that was based on earlier songs, and this is what makes, I think, that interesting, too, is that it was based on a mid-19th century song, The Ship That Never Returned. And there's a theme here of men kind of leaving on new forms of kind of dangerous transportation and not coming back. And the Wreck of Old 97 picks up the Ship That Never Returned, and there were a couple of intervening songs that were more kind of humorous parodies. There was the hand car that never returned. and, of course, it's familiar to us all in some ways, or at least those of us of a certain age, as Charlie and the MTA. You know, and did he ever return? No, he never returned. It's the same tune and basically the same theme, though Charlie's problem is his wife won't give him the nickel to get him off the train. The wreck.
We don't have on hand the hand car that never returned, but we do have Wreck of Old 97. So let's take a listen to that for a moment.
Well, they gave him his orders at Monroe, Virginia, saying, "Steal your way behind time. This is not 38, but it's old 97. You must put her in Danville on time." turned around fast to his black grease fireman, saying, shovel on a little more coal. And when we reach that wide oak mountain, you can watch old 97 roll. It's a mighty rough road from Lynchburg to Danville, all alone on a 3 mile grade. It was on this grade that he lost his head, and you can see what a jump he made. He was going down grade, making 90 miles an hour, when his whistle broke into a scream. He was found in the wreck with his hand on the throttle. He was scalded to death by the steam. Ladies, now you must take warning from this time now and learn. Never speak hard words to your true loving husband. He may leave you and never return.
That was Leon Copas, if I'm
okay, I was going to ask you that. It wasn't a version I was familiar with.
A fun version, nonetheless.
Yeah, yeah. It's an interesting song in that a very popular singer in the 1920s, Vernon Dalhart, was one of the first people to record it, though there were different versions of the song. And it was one of the first million sellers, actually, in terms of recorded music. And because of the different versions, apparently it got into some very serious copyright disputes, and the suits went on for about a decade, and eventually were settled for something like $60,000, which in the 1930s was
a lot of money,
significant sum in the 1930s. So, you know, and Dalhart recorded a number of other songs too, but this was, you know, a pretty well-known one, obviously.
This is you mentioned this in your chapter on the man who never returned, and it really is about transportation and a transformation that's happening in the United States in terms of the ability to travel and to leave one's family, or the necessity to leave one's family. Mm-hmm. And this is one that, while it tells a sad story, but it's not a sad sounding song.
No. No, it has a certain kind of upbeat quality to it, doesn't it? But as I said, the ship that never returned, and even Charlie and the MTA do tell the kind of the story. And it is the dangers of transportation, you know. And one of the things, you know, if you read mid-19th century newspapers at all, they're just full of stories of shipwrecks and train wrecks and steamships that blow up their boilers and things like that. So the transportation revolution was a tremendously important moment, not only in U.S. history, but really for the world, and the 19th century saw that. But it came with a considerable cost that I think we tend to ignore in these days, and these songs in some ways remind us of that.
You're listening to Focus 580. I'm Leanne Donner, sitting in this hour for David Inge, and my guest is Robert V. Wells, author of Life Flows On, an Endless Song, Folk Songs and American History. If you have a question or comment, we'd love to hear from you at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. You devote a chapter to hard times. Nobody knows the trouble I've seen. But it seems like so many folk songs are about sadness or tragedy.
Hard times, right.
It's like, where do the blues pick up and the folk songs?
Sure. I mean, yes, in some ways, you know, the whole book could have been entitled Hard Times. You know, it actually is kind of interesting. There are not a whole lot of folk songs about kind of really cheerful moments. I mean, there clearly are songs that are fun and entertaining, oftentimes children's songs, you know, where you're kind of playing games. But, you know, in terms of kind of upbeat, optimistic songs, they're fairly rare, I suppose. Maybe you don't need music so much when you're feeling good, but you need the music to kind of. I've always, you know, I can, if I want to change my mood, I can find, figure out songs to kind of shift the mood, and if I want to just enhance it, I can figure out songs to do that. And I suspect people have used music that way, and songs, for a long, long time.
We have a caller on line four from Belgium. Good morning.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. I wanted you to possibly talk about a Peter, Paul, and Mary song that there's always been a controversy about, and that's Puff the Magic Dragon. There seem to be a whole lot of stories about that one.
Okay, that's actually not a song that I really address here. My book is actually more on kind of older roots music. I really don't have a lot to say about contemporary folk style music. But that's, you know, that, yeah, it's whether this was about marijuana or not. As was, you know, if not at the time people were talking about it. You know, I guess, you know, it's like any good folk song or any good poem, I suppose, in some ways. It's open to multiple interpretations, and, you know, you read into it what you
want.
need to and want to at the time. So, you know, I think they made the argument that it wasn't, but whether that was just to, you know, continue to make it commercially viable or not, I'm not sure.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thank you for your call. So many times I think that death comes up a lot in folk songs,
right.
and sometimes we don't even realize the extent to which it's there, and that's even true in children's literature and children. Like, you know, you probably, as a historian, you probably know this. I was surprised to learn that Ring Around the Rosie was really a reference to the plague.
The plague, right.
And, you know, probably even today children grow up doing Ring Around the Rosie, pocket
right.
full of posy, ashes, all fall down, and not realizing that we're talking about people getting
right.
the
right.
red spots on their face and dying of the plague.
Right.
But I guess it's a way of moving on and living life and getting past.
And also just, you know, from when these songs come from, that death was a much more, I wouldn't want to say commonplace because it happens to us all eventually, but it certainly was much more, you know, people died in the home. People would have been more familiar with death. It would have been something that children would have had to have been prepared psychologically in some ways for the possible death of their parents or a sibling who would have died at home. And so these were ways of reminding people that you needed to think about this and to be prepared. There certainly are some songs that remind people of the need for preparation and that, you know, Little Black Train, to kind of link back to the train songs a little bit. So Little Black Train's a-coming. It's coming down the track. Little Black Train is coming. It ain't going to take, you know, it's not going to bring you back, that kind of thing, that to remind you of that. So
we have a caller from Charleston on line one.
Okay.
Good morning.
Good morning. The remark about songs about hard times struck a chord. My grandmother, who was born in 1882, used to sing a song about Pat Malone, who forgot that he was, who had struck on hard times. Are you familiar?
The song, what, the Pat?
Pat Malone. I think, you know, I've thought about it too historically. It's kind of anti-Irish too. But anyhow, about Pat Malone,
okay.
who had come on hard times, and he decided that he would die and his family could collect the insurance. And the refrain went, then Pat Malone forgot that he was dead. I mean, it went through the whole thing
uh-huh.
about how he prepared for this. And he stood up and he said, and my grandmother would say this something like, by thunder, in the end, Pat Malone decided on the way to the graveyard that he didn't want to do this.
Uh-huh.
Have you ever heard of this song?
I have not. You know.
And the only and my mother and her sister would try to reconstruct it, and they really could not. Maybe
okay.
if I try on the internet, right?
You know, there are a lot of song lyrics. There's a wonderful site for folk song lyrics called the Mudcat Forum. And I, you know, that would be the place I would start. But otherwise, just, you know, type in Pat Malone and lyrics, and there's a chance that somebody somewhere has already kind of found it.
Yeah, because I'm sure that my mother said that her grandparents
uh-huh.
would come to their house. She grew up in West Virginia,
uh-huh.
but her relatives came out of southeastern Ohio too.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, we loved it when we were a kid for grandmother to sing that. because
oh, it sounds like a delightful song.
Risque. Yeah. No, it was, here is this man trying to fool everybody.
Right, right.
Because of hard times. Uh-huh. The other one my grandmother sang that we can't remember all the words for was the old the young man who wouldn't hoe corn.
Right, right.
And we liked that one very much too.
Uh-huh. That's a classic, certainly.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you could find that on.
Oh, that one. In fact, I have a couple of books that were collected by people from one of the state colleges in West Virginia, and there's my grandmother's version of that and some of the other songs in that. But the one we really would like to find is Pat Malone.
Well, as I said, I think, you know, if you just go on, you know, a search engine and type that in, I think.
You know, I've never done that, but I think I will. You've brought it to my mind.
Right, and you know, or try this Mudcat forum.
I will.
It's a wonderful place to have all kinds of lyrics.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And there's also a wonderful recording of the man who wouldn't hoe corn, and I'm trying to remember now. It's either Jerry Douglas or Dan Tabitsky. Because I've seen it live with, when I was going to see Alison Krauss, so who is, as we all know, from Champaign, Illinois. Not that we're proud of that or anything, but
rightly to be proud.
Pete Seeger, of course, and Woody Guthrie play pivotal roles in the promotion of folk music in our time and a little bit before our time. Could you talk for a moment about Woody Guthrie and his writing This Land Is Your Land?
Okay. Guthrie is a fascinating person, a truly gifted artist. I mean, it's really interesting to compare him, as I do in the chapter, to Leadbelly, who is I think a far more gifted musician than Guthrie, but nowhere near the lyricist that Guthrie was. And Guthrie actually drew well and wrote well. And This Land Is Your Land was in part a reaction to God Bless America. That, you know, it was written in 1940, and the Depression was not yet over. And he thought that God Bless America was, in a sense, too celebratory for the time. In fact, some of the kind of ending versions of this did God Bless America for Me. I mean, he did later change the song and kind of edited out some of his verses that were more kind of blunt social kind of commentary, where he was reminding people that, you know, times really aren't all that good, and that lots of people are suffering. He had a social vision, certainly, and used his music and his lyrics to comment on it.
Well, let's take a listen.
Sure.
If you don't mind, to This Land Is Your Land.
Okay.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, above me that endless skyway, I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York.
Well, it's a song that we all grew up singing in
Good Weaver's school version. There.
Yeah, Good Weaver's version. And, you know, when we learn it in elementary school, we probably don't realize that it's a response to God Bless America, which we...
And that there are some verses that are somewhat more pointed. But, you know, it's kind of classic Guthrie in that he takes an old familiar tune. I mean, I've often thought that, you know, you can take a collection of Carter Family albums and kind of listen to them and get about 90% of Guthrie's tunes out of that. So he just took old tunes. Little Darlin' Pal of Mine, I think, was that, and that was actually based on an earlier hymn. Reworked it, but it's obviously the lyrics that make that a special song. And very much, you know, Guthrie was very much a fan of Walt Whitman and envisioned himself in some ways as doing the same kind of things that Walt Whitman, and people have made the observation that his lyrics are very Whitman-esque in their kind of celebration of the natural world and the kind of wonders that really are part of the United States, this extraordinary, beautiful land of ours. And there's a certainly positive element of that in this song.
Would you give us an example or two of verses that most of us probably haven't heard?
Oh, let me see if I can remember one off the top of my head. That the kind of last one is, one bright morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people. As I stood there hungry, I stood there wondering if God blessed America for me.
Wow.
And then the classic, kind of much funnier, and I can't remember the exact lines, but it's basically, as I went wandering, I saw the sign there. The sign said private property. On the backside, it didn't say nothing. That's the side that's made for you and me. Woody, it's really kind of interesting. Arlo Guthrie, his son, tells a story about as Woody was beginning his kind of tragic descent into the problems of Huntington's chorea, he called Arlo in and basically said, you know, Arlo, you need to know the whole song, and sat him down and sang him the whole song.
Wow. So it was a new experience for his son as well.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Focus 580. I'm Leanne Donner, sitting in this morning for David Inge. You can join the conversation if you have a question or a comment. The number to call is 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Ask a question of Robert V. Wells, who is the author of Life Flows On, An Endless Song, Folk Songs, and American History. Rock Island Line is a song that has an interesting history. Can you talk about that for just a moment?
Oh, gosh.
Something near and dear to folks in Illinois?
Rock Island Line. I'm drawing a blank on that, actually, at the moment. Can you give me what did you have in mind particularly?
Why don't we listen to it for
right.
a moment,
okay,
and
sure.
Maybe that'll
okay.
help us.
This is Rock Island Line. I go out on the people blows the train whistle, talk to the depot agent. Depot agent throw that switchboard over the line, and ain't never gonna talk to him. I got goats, I got sheep, I got cows, I got hogs, I got horses, I got all livestock, I got all livestock. Now that old Rock Island Line is getting on down the road. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're bound to get your ticket and station on the Rock Island Line. Jesus died to save our sins. Glory to God, we're going to meet him again. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. If you want us to ride, you got to ride it like you're bound to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. A, B, C, double X, Y, Z. Yes, they're in the cupboard, but they don't see me. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. If you want us to ride, you got to ride it like you're bound to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. I may be right and I may be wrong, but you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're bound to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a road to ride. Oh, the Rock Island Line, it's a mighty good road. If you want to ride, you got to ride it like you're bound to get your ticket at the station on the Rock Island Line.
And that was Lead Belly.
Yes, indeed. And Rock Island Line, to me at least, is a very nice example of a zipper song. And that's kind of the wonderful chorus. And it tells us, you know, there's a certain story to it, but I've often heard it, if, you know, people add, you know, just use the chorus and you can add various commentary, you know. Moses standing at the Red Sea source, smiting at the water with a 2x4. Jesus died to save our sins. Glory be to God. We're going to need him again, which doesn't really have much to do with the chorus, but it's just a wonderful song that you can sing. One of the things I like to do with my class is I have one class where we write folk lyrics, and I give them three or four tunes to, hey, here's some tunes to work with. Now, kind of write something about, you know, life in college, or, you know, contemporary politics, or whatever you want to write about. And oftentimes they like that particular tune. It has a nice drive to it.
And you sort of can almost envision prisoners on a chain gang singing while they're working.
Right, right.
We have a caller on the line, on line one, from Champaign.
Good.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm really appreciating the show, and can you tell me again the name of your book?
Life Flows On in Endless Song.
Oh, from...
From the hymn.
Ooh, How Can I Keep From Singing?
Yes, indeed, yes.
Okay, and your name?
Robert Wells.
That's easy, okay.
With a V in the middle.
Well, thank you for that call.
I'm not done.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
How do you spell your last name?
Wells.
I thought you said a V in the middle.
No, Robert V. Wells. Miller.
Initial.
So.
Oh.
They're, you know.
All right.
If you go onto Amazon and just put Robert Wells, you're going to get a lot of other stuff, too.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. I have a question about a song whose lyrics I haven't been able to find for like 50 years. It's called Sweet Violets. Are you familiar with it?
Sweet Violets. Oh, my.
There once was a farmer who took a young miss, and back of the farm where he gave her a lecture on horses and chickens and eggs and told her that she had such beautiful manners that suited a girl of her charms, one he would like to take in his washing and ironing, and then if he did, they could get married and have lots of sweet violets.
I do have a dim memory. It's not something I kind of include in the book. I remember hearing it. I hadn't thought about that song in probably 40 years at least.
I don't know. Do you think I'd find that on the...
I would just put Sweet Violets in quotes and put it into the Google search or try the Mudcat forum.
M-U-D-C-A-T?
M-U-D-C-A-T. Mudcat forum. It's a wonderful place to find all kinds of lyrics, and it's nicely alphabetized.
Cap like you wear in your head, or cat like...
Cap, C-A-T.
Okay. All right. It's hard to hear the difference
on
the radio.
Right.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you for your call.
Good luck.
And we also have a call from Charleston on line two.
Okay.
Hi. I'm the one that called you a while ago.
Okay.
And I want to thank you for telling me about Mudcat, because I did just go in and type in Pat Malone, forgot that he was dead. But they give credit to Mudcat for the, and they have the music and the words.
So you found it. Terrific.
I found it. And I thought about the one the previous caller was just talking about. One of the songs my grandmother sang, too, was sort of risque, kind of like that Sweet Violets, because you could put in an unusable word.
Right, right.
At the end of it. And that would be like those you're talking about that you could just go on and on and on with, right?
Right, the zipper song, right?
And kind of... And then the other one I wanted to ask you about, because my mother, who just died at 102, told us about singing. She would go to somebody's house back up in a hollow, and these people sang Life's Railway to Heaven. Well,
I figured
Life's Railway to Heaven was more like 1920s, 30s. And she said they were singing this when she was a child in the 1910, 1912.
It actually dates from, I think, around 1890.
Yeah. So, it really shocked me that, I thought that fit in with, but she wanted that, and one of my cousins recorded it, and we played it almost every day for a month or two.
Actually, there's at least a little discussion of that in Norm Cohen's book, Long Steel Rail, which is also University of Illinois Press. I originally knew the tune. The tune got transferred over into a labor song.
Well, I
Miner's Lifeguard.
Good, yeah.
But it's a interesting song, wonderful song. But as I said, I think at least it's 1890 in origin.
Yeah, when I looked it up. She had a wonderful memory for songs and poetry, and just the week before she died, her mind was always sharp, but she began to quote a poem about the War of 1812 in Lake Erie and someone who was a hero. Anyhow, I picked up enough of the words to get a verse or two. I went in and found it.
Uh-huh.
Found the whole thing.
Good.
And she
terrific.
Shocked us because of how she could remember all
uh-huh,
these things.
Uh-huh.
But I do appreciate, I'll look on Mudcat for other things.
Well, I use it all the time. You know, you kind of have a little, and the nice thing about Mudcat is it will give you some different versions, and then on some of the songs, there's quite a long, you'll get discussions over where it comes from and its roots. And
I think the reason that we as little kids like this was because Pat Malone raised himself up in the coffin. Well, the car driver wanted paid to take him to the cemetery.
Uh-huh.
And he said, if you fairly doubt my credit, you'll be sorry that you said it. You drive on or else the corpse will break your head. And so little kids would think that was funny anyhow.
Yeah. It sounds a little bit like Finnegan's Wake, actually.
You know, well, then I should, really? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
I could look it up, both of them, and see.
Right.
I never thought about that. I mean,
right.
I don't think I really paid that much attention to Finnegan's Wake.
No, well, you know, these songs are worth paying attention to. That's kind of part of, if there's a message, I think, to my book, it's that you know, these songs which we enjoy really deserve to be at least occasionally thought about on a more serious level and how they link to other songs, so...
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Another tune that is near and dear to those of us here in Champaign-Urbana, of course, is City of New Orleans.
Uh-huh, right.
You talk about that has some other interesting roots as well.
Right, right. That's a wonderful song, Steve Goodman. And, you know, it's the Illinois Central, I suppose, the song I like to parrot, well, two songs, actually, that I like to think about it. With it. One is Casey Jones, which again is a real train wreck. That was 3 years before the wreck of old 97 when he was on the southbound road and again, trying to make up lost time and went off and, you know, hit. There was a train that wasn't quite off the track. It was a freight train and they hadn't gotten it all the way off the track. And there are actually pictures of that, too. And the other, though it's not specifically linked to the Illinois Central, doesn't get mentioned, is Elizabeth Cotton's wonderful little tune called Freight Train, which I think, you know, don't tell them which train I'm on so they don't know which route I've gone, which I think is a reference to African-Americans leaving the South and moving up to Chicago, where they would have taken the Illinois Central, and heading north to see if they could get away from the Jim Crow South and to find better jobs as well. That's a wonderful, wonderful song.
It is, and let's hear just a little bit of it.
Good.
Riding on the City of New Orleans, Illinois Central Monday morning rail. There are 15 cars and 15 restless riders, 3 conductors and 25 sacks of mail. They're all out on the southbound Odyssey, and the train pulls out of Kankakee, rolls past the houses, farms, and fields, passing towns that have no name, and freight yards full of old black men, and the graveyards of rusted automobiles. Singing, good morning, America, how are you? Saying, don't you know me, I'm your native son. Yes, I'm the train they call the City of New Orleans. And I'll be gone 500.
Well, you know, the City of New Orleans goes right through Champaign every day.
Along the southbound Odyssey.
That's right.
Right.
Well,
one of the great kind of modern railroad songs. Kind of, what a wonderful heritage.
It is a wonderful heritage. You learn so much. You can really learn almost the entire history of our country, really, if you you look back at just the folk music that's come through. And especially if you take the time to really delve into the stories behind them all and the societies in which they were written and the communities.
You mentioned earlier that I basically arrange these songs topically for, you know, various reasons. But I have thought that that somebody could, I'm not sure I would want to myself, could take these songs or a whole bunch of other wonderful folk songs and really write a more chronological approach to American history as well.
Well, your book is really, I have to say, fascinating and a lot of fun. You could just go through it and go to the library and get some of these collections of folk songs
right.
and sort of listen your way through the book and learn a lot about American history. My guest today is Robert V. Wells, author of Life Flows On in Endless Song, Folk Songs and American History. It is published, I'm proud to say, by the University of Illinois Press. And I want to say thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much. They're such wonderful songs. It's always a pleasure to listen to them and talk about them.
And we're going to have to wrap it up, but there is more of Focus 580 coming up in a few minutes. We'll have a break first for the market update and news from NPR. I'm Leanne Donner, sitting in this hour for David Inge on Focus 580, and we appreciate your being with us today.
Support for Focus 580 comes from Bodywork Associates, bringing precision neuromuscular massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Now with four area locations, including inside the new Activities and Recreation Center north of Memorial Stadium on the U of I campus. More information is at bodyworkassociates.com.
WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the marketplace where at mid-session, not a lot of movement one way or another in the marketplace. That means that this morning's quarterly grain stocks report, essentially a non-event in traders' minds. Corn stocks coming in for September at 1.674 billion soybeans, 138 million, and wheat 2.215 billion bushels. Let's go ahead and go to the pits in Kansas City and Chicago and get caught up on the current marketings in Kansas City. December wheat now trading 461 and three quarters, down 6 3/4. March 478 and three quarters, down 6. May 490 and three quarters, down 5 1/2. December wheat at CME Group 443 and a quarter, down 4 1/4. March 463 and a half, down 3 3/4. May 475 and a half, down 5 1/2. December corn 341 and a quarter, up a quarter. March 354 and a half, up a half. May 363 and a half, up a half. July 371 and three quarters, up 3/4. September 375, down 4 1/4. November beans 924 and a quarter, up 7 1/4. January 930 and a quarter, up 7 1/2 at 930. March 9:30 and three quarters, up 8 1/4. May 9:24 and three quarters, up 7. July 9:25 and a quarter, up 6 3/4. August 9:09 1/2, and they were down 2 1/2. October soybean meal at 2.88 is unchanged, and December soybean meal is at 284.70, and it is